to day on against the grain. When the problem is religious polarization and inequality, the solution, we're often told, is secular governance, which promotes equality regardless of religious affiliation. But does secularism deliver what it promises? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Saba Mahmood about her book, Religious Difference in a Secular Age, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Because equality, civil, political, and religious equality, is what modern secularism promises, secular government is widely seen as the solution to religious tensions and inequality. If religious minorities in certain countries are treated badly, we tend to attribute that to systems of power that aren't secular or aren't secular enough. But what if modern secular governance, while promising religious equality, in fact exacerbates religious inequalities? What if interreligious conflict has been aggravated rather than reduced by secularism? What should we make of secularism's claim that it can be a neutral arbiter of religious differences? And finally, what if what we've come to understand about and expect from the secular state and its political logic and legal institutions, what if all of that actually limits and constrains our political imagination in important ways? Saba Mahmood called into question much of the received wisdom about secularism and about the divisions between East and West in her award-winning book, Religious Difference in a Secular Age, A Minority Report. Saba Mahmood was a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley, and her other books include Politics of Piety, The Islamic Revival and the Feminist Subject, and Is Critique Secular? Blasphemy, Injury, and Free Speech, which she co-authored. When Saba joined me in studio in early 2016, I asked her to define a key term in her book, political secularism.
We tend to think that secularism is about the separation of church and state, and we tend to think that secularism is about state's neutrality toward religion, so no single religion is necessarily favored by the state. Increasingly, in the Anglo-American Academy, this conception of secularism has come to be rethought. And what is now argued is that secularism is not so much the separation of church and state, but it is the increasing involvement of the state in the regulation of religious life in the modern period. Now, what this means is that once the state starts to regulate religious life, almost to an unprecedented degree in human history with the emergence of the modern state, that in fact then it also compromises the strict separation of religion and state, and the principle of state neutrality. Actually, the state cannot necessarily remain neutral once it becomes embedded in the regulation of religious life. And this is simply because once the state becomes embedded and once the state starts to regulate religious life, it constantly has to make judgments about what is or is not religion, what it will consider a proper religious practice so as to give it protection versus not. If you just think about the United States, for example, we tend to think that there is the First Amendment and that ensures the complete freedom of religion, but we also see that the state has to actually define what kind of religious institutions will have the protection of the state, what kind of religious exemptions will they get, what kind of tax exemptions will they get. Similarly, even common public spaces that we regard as religious spaces, such as cemeteries, are actually regulated by the state, and certain signs and symbols are considered to be proper display of religious belonging and others not. So if you begin to actually look at the practice of the state rather than simply the principle of the state, then you have to say that actually secularism is a lot more complicated. And in fact, there is a fundamental paradox that haunts political secularism.
And what is that paradox?
The fundamental paradox is that on the one hand, the state, in all earnestness, promises state neutrality towards religion. So, in other words, no citizen will be treated differently because he or she has a certain religious belief. So all citizens are equal in the eyes of the law, regardless of their religious beliefs. And on the other hand, by virtue of the state being involved in the regulation of religious life, it constantly has to take a position. It constantly has to reify certain religious beliefs while delegating others as not compatible to what it thinks, what the state thinks is properly or normatively religious, and which constantly these two aspects of political secularism constantly create a paradox and a contradiction, but it's a very generative contradiction.
So secular government comes with its own sort of rationality, its political rationality, and you've begun talking about it, this ideal of equality before the law without regard to religious affiliation. What are some of the other key elements of the political rationality that goes with secular government?
So there are two primary things that I would actually think about as a means to answer your question. One is that in defining what is properly considered to be religious or not, and therefore worthy of state protection, or for that matter, state indifference, regardless of the state protection or state indifference, it is the state's prerogative to define what is or is not religious. Now, that does not, of course, mean that everybody who practices any kind of religion in modern society only blindly follows what the state prescribes. But it does mean that when rival religious claims are made in the public sphere and the political sphere, it is the state, it's the prerogative of the state to define what is proper religiosity versus not. So this is one aspect of political secularism, and we tend to really not think about it. As long as we continue to think that secularism consists of state neutrality toward religion, we fail to therefore see what are the normative ways in which the state defines religion and religious practice. And a second defining feature of political secularism is what is known to be the right to religious belief, where everybody is free to believe in whatever they choose to believe. Now, almost all over the world, when we think about the right to religious belief, and this is true for national laws and international laws, the right to religious belief, on the one hand, is regarded as sacrosanct. But on the other hand, the state, the modern state, also reserves the right to actually regulate religious practices while letting religious belief remain sacrosanct and a space of special protection. So, particularly in European law, but also in various Middle Eastern constitutions and then all over the world in South and Southeast Asia too, what you have is that the right to religious freedom has two components. One is an individual's right to believe whatever he chooses to believe or not believe, and on the other hand, the right to manifest that religious belief, which is necessarily material, outward, and takes place in the public sphere.
So there's kind of a public-private distinction. The public manifestation of religious belief could be regulated or should be regulated, whereas the private, what somebody does kind of internally and at home, is not the province of the state?
That is exactly right. That's a very good way of putting it, that there is a public and private distinction. And so the right to religious liberty, on the one hand, allows the state to say, well, we have given you complete freedom to believe in whatever you want to believe. But on the other hand, the state retains the right, the prerogative, to actually say when a certain expression of that belief contradicts what is considered to be the public order of a society, then that practice can be legally and legitimately regulated. The most blatant example of this is, of course, the decision in France to ban the headscarves that Muslim women wear from places of public employment and public education. Their argument was that they were not necessarily regulating religious beliefs, Muslim religious beliefs, but what they were regulating was actually the expression of that belief, which was incongruent or in contradiction with the secular sensibilities and ethos of French society.
Are there other elements of the political rationality that goes with political secularism that are relevant to your analysis and that you want to bring out right now?
Yes, I do. There are two other elements of political secularism that I touch upon in my book that actually are very important. One of them is the idea that the right to religious liberty is about the right of a person, of an individual, to believe in whatever he chooses to believe or not to believe. Now, as soon as we say that, we should recognize that what we are privileging is the conscience, the interiority of the individual. And so, in a sense, religion itself, in the right to religious liberty, ironically, is defined in accord with the Protestant notion of religion, religion as private belief that an individual practices in the privacy of his or her conscience and the privacy of his or her own church or home. And when other forms of religiosity conflict with this Protestant conception of religiosity, that's when a problem often arises. Now, if you think about the various notions of religion that people have in the world, they don't actually easily concord with this particular notion of individualized, privatized conscience of the individual, which is the bearer of religious life. Often people, in fact, if you think about the Judaic tradition, the Orthodox tradition, or if you think of the Muslim Orthodox tradition, it's not just simply what you believe or not to believe, do not believe, but it is about how you practice religion, whether you practice kosher, whether you fast, whether you behave in certain ways, and so on and so forth, and the community that is created through those practices. And so modern political secularism, particularly in its legal form, actually gives protection to a certain notion of religion, which is what I call normative religion, that reifies this individualized privacy notion of religion. And in fact, you find this not just in the United States. You now have this language that is encoded in almost all the constitutions of the world. So, for example, I worked in Egypt where the Baha'is, which are a small minority in Egypt, their religion is considered to be quote-unquote banned. But on the other hand, these Baha'is are also allowed to participate in the political and civic life of the country. When they have tried to take the case to the courts and argue that actually the Constitution gives them the right to religious belief, and by virtue of banning their religion, the country is actually abrogating their right as citizens, the courts have come back and said, well, you're free to believe in whatever you choose to believe. What we are actually regulating is the manifestation of your religious belief. And so this really connects up to the earlier component of political secularism I was writing about, or I was discussing earlier, which is the distinction between private and public. And a final and fourth component of political secularism that I discuss in my book is that regardless of however secular a state may be, it also encodes within its national culture and within its laws majoritarian values, sensibilities, and religious practices. And this goes hand in hand with the same state claiming to be religiously neutral towards its citizens. It isn't considered to be a contradiction. So, for example, as many people have noted, that the United States, on the one hand, has the First Amendment, which gives an absolute amnesty to people regarding their religious beliefs. But on the other hand, the larger popular ethos of the culture, and not just simply the culture, but the way that culture permeates the courts and the laws that are made in this country, is actually personifies, embodies Protestant religiosity of a particular kind. So that's an example. When religious practices that come in conflict with that majoritarian ethos, that is when usually the things are taken to the courts and they're fought in courts where judges and claimants and so on constantly joust between what is considered to be the minoritarian religious practice and what is considered to be the nationally condoned majoritarian religious practice.
And by majoritarian ethos, you mean kind of the ethos informed by what the majority of, say, a nation's population believes in or feels is right.
That is right. Right.
Saba Mahmoud, in conversation with me about her book, Religious Difference in a Secular Age, A Minority Report. The program is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Sabo was a professor of anthropology at UC Berkeley. We return now to more of that interview.
So you referred earlier to public order and the notion of public order, and I think this brings together a number of things you've been talking about. So what is public order? How is it defined, say, in legal terms? And how has that notion been used to regulate not necessarily religious belief, right, the interior religious belief of people, but the outward manifestations of their belief, the practices, the rites, and the rituals?
So public order is a legal concept that comes about in the 19th century. Initially, it comes out of the French Civil Code, and it belongs initially to competing juridical regimes and how to actually deal with conflicts between competing juridical regimes around the world. And it is an expression of the national sovereignty of a state to actually annul its agreements with other states, but also annul its own laws when the state regards a certain practice to stand in contradiction or in violation of its commitment to secure the public order, the health, morality of the society. Now, invariably, public order is understood to be that legal instrument that the states can use to justify and to legitimately break their international covenants, other international treaties, but also abrogate its own laws in order to basically say this is a moment when the state deems a certain practice to be in contradiction to its larger ethos. Now, how is this larger ethos defined? It is defined precisely in accord with the majoritarian religious cultural sensibilities that the majority of the citizens of a country practice.
So let's take, for example, the issue of wearing headscarves in public in Europe. And there's been a lot of controversy around this. So there have been lawsuits, in fact, around whether, let's say, somebody who is a teacher or a student in a school, in a public school in France, can actually wear the headscarf and what impact that might have on other people. So how has public order, that concept, been deployed by courts in deciding whether or not something like this outward manifestation of Islamist belief can be allowed or should be prohibited?
So that is an excellent question. When the French government banned the wearing of the hijab in public schools and other places of public employment, their reasoning was that this really did not constitute a violation of Muslim beliefs, that Muslim women were free to believe in whatever they want to believe, but what was being regulated was an outward manifestation of that religious belief, which actually contradicted the majoritarian sensibilities of the French people. And in doing so, they actually widely used the concept of public order. When this decision was taken up by the European Court of Human Rights, which has actually jurisdiction over member countries, which are members of the European Union, the European Court of Human Rights upheld the right of the French state to actually regulate the headscarf, to ban the headscarf, precisely because it said that the state had a legitimate interest. And this is the technical term that they use. They had a legitimate interest and therefore the ability to regulate what is otherwise considered to be an expression, a religious expression. Now, what's so interesting is that the European Court of Human Rights has since taken up a number of other court cases. One very famous case was one that they took up in Sweden, where there was a school teacher who came in wearing the headscarf. And she was told not to wear it by the public school. She continued to wear it. Eventually, she was expelled from the school. She took her case to the European Court of Human Rights. And the European Court of Human Rights made the same judgment and made the same argument on the basis of the concept of public order, that the state basically had a legitimate aim in regulating headscarf because it violated the normative ethos of Swedish society. Now, what's so interesting is that there was another case that was brought up that was about the display of a cross in public schools in Italy. And initially, one of the families brought a case against the public school in Italy and said and argued that this was a violation of the right to their religious belief or not to believe, and that the cross should be removed because it was considered to be an undue influence on the young children of this family who were attending the school.
Right, and this was a compulsory display of the crucifixion in the classrooms, correct?
That is correct. This was a compulsory display of the cross in public, in classrooms of public schools in Italy. The Italian government basically said that this could not be regarded as a religious symbol, that it should be regarded as a cultural symbol, and that they did not see that it had any proselytizing effect on the children who were going to these schools who were not, did not share Christian beliefs. This case was again taken up in the European Court of Human Rights. There were two different decisions. The final decision from the higher chamber that came down argued that indeed the cross was not a religious symbol, but a cultural symbol. And in fact, again, on the basis of public order, they said that the state had a legitimate right to actually condone this practice because it reflected the majoritarian sensibilities of Italians who were primarily Christian. So in public order, what you find is a coming together of two fundamental principles of political secularism. One is that it is the prerogative of the state to decide when a religious practice is condoned or when is it tolerated. And a second component of political secularism, which is the majoritarian ethos or the majoritarian values or the values of the religious majority, are the ones that are considered to be most worthy of protection. And they are considered to be equivalent of the national culture. We find countless other examples in the European Court of Human Rights of a very similar kind of reasoning. So, for example, in a very famous case, Otto Preminger case versus the state of Austria, there was a film that was produced in Austria that actually depicted Christ in sexually explicit ways, and that film was banned. The filmmakers took their case to the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights came back and said that actually Austrian government had a right to ban the film precisely because it violated the Christian sensibilities of the majority Austrian population. And then you have a very similar case later, the Wingrove case in the UK. Now, usually when you have these cases, people tend to argue that, oh, this is just simply a contradiction in terms of political secularism, that what these states are doing is that they're protecting majority religion at the expense of minority, and this is a certain kind of a prejudice and a bias. And so the problem lies with the implementation of the law. The states can be actually made more impartial rather than actually try to analyze that across these different contexts. Why is it that the law continues to produce a very similar kind of reasoning and a similar kind of political rationality? And what does it tell us about secularism? And that is really what I try to do in my book. So I don't just take the European court cases. I also analyze a number of cases, Egyptian cases, for example, where you don't have a very explicitly secular, self-avowed secular state, but its laws actually are very similar to the ones that are practiced in Europe. And when minority religious beliefs are discriminated against or they are unfairly regulated, the states end up producing a very similar kind of jurisprudence as the jurisprudence produced by both European national courts and by the European Court of Human Rights.
Sabah Mahmoud was a professor of anthropology at UC Berkeley, and today we are revisiting a conversation about her book, Religious Difference in a Secular Age, A Minority Report. Sabah, who passed away in 2018, also authored the book Politics of Piety, co-authored Is Critique Secular, and co-edited the volume Politics of Religious Freedom. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's return to more of that interview. I want to talk about Egypt because that is a major focus of your book. But from what you're talking about with these court cases, which are based, the rationale of the decisions are often based on this notion of public order, your argument almost seems to be that the state's commitment to equality, which, again, is part of secular governance, modern secular governance as we understand it, is interrupted in a sense, that an exception to religious equality and its promise is made in order to protect and preserve national values and national culture as defined by the majority of its citizens and as supported by, for example, the European Court of Human Rights. In other words, that there is a way that this commitment to equality is overridden by notions of public order.
Yes, I think one of the things that I really wanted to grapple with in this book is that to actually contend with the immensity of the promise of religious equality that secularism made possible for the modern world. This is no small promise. This is an immense promise. It really is a transformative promise in the sense that in a world that was really defined by religious inequalities, you have the birth of the modern state whose foundational premise is that regardless of what your religious belief is, the state is going to treat you equally in the eyes of the law. And so the puzzle is that despite the immensity of this promise, why is it that religious inequality continues to flourish around the world? And by that, I mean not just in other parts of the world, but in our own world. We only need to think about, for example, the treatment of Jews in Europe, which was based on a fundamental premise that Jews, the Jewish religion or Judaism, was somehow fundamentally lesser of a religion than Christianity was. And then, of course, eventually that judgment morphs into a different political rationality, which is the rationality of racism and racial extermination. But we cannot deny the theological sort of judgment on Judaism. And we find a very similar kind of a prejudice against minority religions all over the world. I mean, I think what we are witnessing today in the United States in regard to Muslims, yes, it has a geopolitical component in the sense that because of the 9/11 events and the proliferation of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the actions they have taken against U.S. citizens and so on. But at the same time, the inherent sort of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim rhetoric that has emerged as a result of that, we need to think of that in terms of how minority religions are treated across the states, across different contexts, across different political national histories. So in a nutshell, I was trying to actually figure out in this book is that you have the immensity of the promise of religious equality, which I think we all want and desire. And on the other hand, you have this practice of a prejudice, a continuous prejudice that you see evidence of in the laws and national cultures of various societies against religious minorities. And I wanted to see what the relationship between these two is. And I took Egypt as my test case, which in some cases, for many people, Egypt is a country which is just simply an intolerant society. And so if it practices any kind of discrimination against its minorities, well, why are we surprised? And what I try to show in this book is that actually the discrimination against non-Muslims, whether it be Baha'is or Christians in Egypt, it has very fundamentally modern roots. There was certainly inequality, religious inequality that was practiced in the pre-modern period, but what it looks like today is very different. And in fact, it's very much related to what we think is the panacea for religious inequality, that is secularism and the secular state.
Well, when we talk about Egypt, we butt up against this prejudice, one could say, about non-Western secularism, about how non-Western secularism measures up or doesn't to Western secularism, the kind that we are supposedly familiar with. So how does working with and analyzing and taking apart secularism Egyptian style, how does that help us understand what the main motivations and strategies and tactics of political secularism are?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. So, yes, you're absolutely right. As soon as we start talking about the non-Western world, whether it be Egypt or India or Malaysia or Indonesia, and we see religious discrimination in these societies, it is immediately assumed that they are not adequately secular, that the reason there is a religious intolerance in these societies is that they are culturally intolerant or religiously intolerant. And if they really had a true secular state on the model of Europe or America, then they would just really do away with religious strife and religious intolerance. And I just find this to be a very inadequate way of thinking about the problem. And the reasons are several. One, I really strongly believe that these societies actually also practice a certain kind of secularism, and that this secularism actually shares many elements of the kind of secularism that is practiced in Europe and America. And what are some of those elements? Some of those elements are, for example, the notion of time. Our modern conception of time as empty and homogeneous, in which events kind of unfold in a linear scale, oriented towards a future, a progressive future, unfolding future. Now, that is a notion of temporality that is profoundly secular. It is not bound up by an apocalyptic end of the world, nor a beginning of the world. Similarly, another conception of secularity that is shared across the world is that the operations of the state, the reason of the state, is premised on the interests of the state, the realpolitik, the geopolitics, the economic factor, the reproduction of a certain kind of a political elite and its interests, the reproduction of the military, the separation of the various realms of within economies, the distinction between public and private. All of these are universally shared. Now, so I wanted to actually think about secularism as a shared political rationality that cuts across the globe. And yet it has also come to be suffused by the particular histories and the particular religions of each nation, of each geographical region. So just as secularism in America is suffused by a certain kind of a normative Protestantism, similarly, if you go to a place like Egypt, what you find is that you have this political rationality that structures the functioning of law and state, and yet it is also suffused with Islamic cultural values. And it so happens that the Islamic cultural values are also the values of the majority of the inhabitants of Egypt. So in a sense, there is a conflation between Islam and what is the national culture of Egypt, just as there is a conflation between what American national culture is and what Protestantism is.
The anthropologist Saba Mahmoud talking with me in studio about her book, Religious Difference in a Secular Age, A Minority Report. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. Let's return to more of that interview.
Yeah, and so as you were saying, this sort of majoritarian Muslim Islamic ethos in Egypt, I mean, after all, as you point out in your book, the nation's official religion is Islam, and Sharia is the principal source of Egyptian legislation. That has had, as you've said, negative consequences for example, Baha'is, who are non-Muslim, and what they are able to do. In fact, you referred to the banning of the Baha'i faith. What about Coptic Christians? So this is, of course, a Christian minority in an Islamic, a Muslim-dominated nation. What's happened to that constituency and that church under secular governments that have, at least in their rhetoric, espoused this notion of religious equality and equality under the law, irrespective of religious difference?
So Coptic Orthodox Christians are very interesting church and a very interesting community in the Middle East. They're the largest Christian minority that is currently in residence in any of the countries in the Middle East. They're also an indigenous church in the sense that Coptic Orthodox Christianity did not come about because of foreign proselytization. This is an indigenous church in the sense that it traces its history back to the emergence of the early church, back to the first century. What is interesting about Coptic Orthodox Christianity is that the church had actually suffered under both the Byzantium rulers and the Romans. And they were persecuted against because they were considered to have broken with the consensus, the majoritarian consensus of the Council of Chalcedon. So they have, as a result, had developed a robust resistance to foreign proselytization. So when the Catholic Church and later the Protestant churches sent missions to convert Egyptians, they did not just aim to convert Muslims and Jews in Egypt, they also aimed to convert the Coptic Orthodox Christians to either Catholicism or to Protestantism. So Coptic Orthodox Church had practiced a politics of resistance against foreign incursions. And so by the time colonialism arrives, by the time the British come and they start ruling Egypt, they were equally resisted by Muslim Egyptians as they were resisted by Coptic Orthodox Christians, because they saw in the coming of the colonial powers a resonance with the earlier missions that the Protestants and Catholics had sent to convert them and to really do away the authority of the Coptic Orthodox Church. I think what's so ironic is that despite the fact that the Muslims and Christians came together in Egypt to resist British colonial rule and eventually throw the British out, in the post-colonial period, discrimination against Coptic Christians has continued. And in fact, if anything, their situation has in some senses become worse.
And why is that? Why has the situation of Coptic Christians in Egypt become worse?
It's become worse for a variety of different reasons, and this is what I write about in the book. It would be easy to assume, and indeed it is assumed, that the reason that the Coptic Orthodox Christians have become subjected to intolerance in Egypt is because Egypt has become more and more Islamicized. And what I argue in my book is that certainly, yes, Egypt has become more Islamicized, but the Christians also have become more Christianized. And what are the reasons for that? What are the factors that have provided for this?
I'm going to guess that it has something to do with secular government in Egypt.
Yes, and here we have to really expand the notion of secularism as a separation of church and state. We have actually, I analyze a whole host of different set of policies and regimes that have ruled over Egypt. And what I find so interesting is that regardless of which regime it is, whether it's the quasi-socialist regime of Nasser or it is the more Islamically clothed regime of President Anwar Sadat in the 80s and then the Mubarak regime that comes to power later, what you find is that the situation of Coptic Orthodox Christians continues to be one of beleagueredness. And here I trace a whole set of policies, and what I argue is that the privatization of public goods in Egypt has led to an increasingly importance of religion assigned in the public sphere. So, for example, just as the state withdraws from the provision of basic public services, what you find is that that role is increasingly taken up by the mosque and the churches, and they come to actually play an increasingly important role in the provision of those services. And once they do, then the religious markers of the citizens becomes pronounced.
But the privatization of the economy and of state-owned enterprises, say, for example, under Mubarak, I mean, that's not necessarily a political secular project. That seems to be more of a neoliberal project within a secular context. So in that sense, are we moving on to maybe a different kind of political economic transition or phenomenon that would explain not just the privatization, but also the consequences on the Coptic Christian community?
Well, that's an excellent question, because I think what you're pointing to is that secularism is really deeply intertwined with neoliberalism, with liberalism, with modern day economics, right? So you have to actually try to, just as when we at a certain period in time, we academics used to talk about modernity. Modernity was an element of the state and modern governance. Modernity was a part of economics. Modernity also was also a certain kind of a cultural attitude and sensibility. And so modernity had to be theorized on a number of different levels: economic, sociocultural, the basis of the state, And similarly, when we begin to think about secularism, we have to really begin to think not just simply the separation of politics and religion, but we actually have to think of how a certain kind of a neoliberal economic rationality allows for a certain kind of religiosity to flourish and therefore has a bearing on how the secular is defined and practiced in reality. So when I analyze this period where you have increasingly the privatization of public goods, but also the retreat of the state from any kind of public services, that's not driven by religious interests, strictly speaking, right? What drives this economic rationality, we find that operative all over the world. It is the very rationality of market capitalism that has reached a certain pinnacle in the form of neoliberal capitalism. And it manifests itself through the privatization of public goods and the retreat of the state from the provision of social services. So strictly speaking, it does not have, is driven by a certain kind of necessarily a religious sensibility or a religious agenda. But it does affect what happens to religion. So what I try to show is that the reasons why Islam has become so important to Egyptians from the 70s onwards, and the reason why Christianity has become so important to Coptic Orthodox Christians in Egypt since the 1970s, does not necessarily have to do with the intrinsic religiosity that was always there, latent, and then it just needed to burst, but that there are structural reasons that are not necessarily religious reasons. We might even think of them as secular developments that has actually changed how Egyptians are perceiving their religiosity and practicing it.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Today we are re-airing a 2016 interview with Saba Mahmoud about her book, Religious Difference in a Secular Age. Saba taught anthropology at UC Berkeley. Here's the final portion of that interview.
You know, there's so much we could talk about in addition to what you've said about Egypt and the Coptic Christian situation, but I kind of want to begin wrapping up and to say that many people might interpret the thesis of your book as, you know, an assault on secularism, right? So secularism, as you've said, has this, brings with it this promise of equality, of civic equality, political equality, and religious equality. And the secular state represents itself as sort of a neutral arbiter of religious difference. And you're saying, no, this isn't the case at all. There are many reasons rooted in secularism for religious inequality and religious discrimination in Egypt and far beyond. So are you saying really that the secular state cannot be a neutral arbiter, that there are no conditions under which a modern secular liberal state can fulfill the promise of religious equality that it so liberally propagates?
Well, I think what I am saying is that the modern secular liberal state has not been a neutral arbiter of religious differences. That if we look historically and in the contemporary world, what we see is that in fact the state is not being a neutral arbiter. It is, in fact, prejudiced towards the majority religious sensibilities of its citizenry. Now, does that mean that we therefore have to do away with secularism? I don't think that secularism can be done away with any more than modernity can be done away with. This is the fundamental reality of our modern life. But unless we understand how the very principles that we value in secularism, political and civil equality, religious equality, the ability of the state and the law to actually to treat all its citizens equally, if we actually really value these principles and we see that these principles are actually being compromised by the very structure that's supposed to uphold them, then we have to actually think of different solutions. And those solutions have to come from within the very premises, the secular premises that are very important principles. In other words, the only way that we can fix a system is to first understand what is wrong with it And if we do not accept that there is anything wrong with it, then I think we are just destined to kind of reproduce the problems without actually understanding where those problems are coming from.
To what extent do you see the first impulse of people who see religious conflict happening out there, their first impulse to say, well, we need secularism, we need more secularism, we need more complete secularism. To what extent do you see that impulse, and what does that tell you about the political imagination of people, of the ability of people to think about undoing religious hierarchy and religious discrimination without thinking about the state and the secular state and how it might come to the rescue and solve our problems?
Well, I think that the ideal of religious equality should not be reduced to simply legal equality. Because once we do that, what we tend to think is that then the only way to create religious equality within a society is by asking the state to arbitrate religious differences, to create laws that are going to actually secure religious equality. Indeed, if, as I argue in my book, the modern secular state actually perpetrates religious inequality, and it does not actually preserve religious equality, then should we not try to think of what other means are available to establish religious equality without constantly turning to the state that in its very political structural logic cannot but represent interests of the majority, speak in the name of the majority, because that is what it is beholden to do. In other words, what I argue for is separating the social imaginary of religious equality from the strict political imaginary of religious equality, which is necessarily understood to be bounded to the state. Let me say it in a different way. What I argue is that secular, in a sense, domesticates the potential and promise of the principle of religious equality by making it the prerogative of the state.
So if we can return to Egypt, and I'm thinking back to your last answer about how people keep looking to the rule of law as the savior, as the way of rectifying things, what does it say to you that people whose liberties have been severely curtailed by the Sisi government, what does it say to you that these people seem to continue to be pressing forward with claims that, look, all we need is more rule of law and our social and political problems will be addressed?
Well, I think it's understandable that against authoritarian regimes or the collapse of any kind of state or legal order that people would say that it is really law that is the savior and law that is going to actually restore a modicum of sanity to an otherwise fractious polity. But I also think that it is really important to understand that the law is not never in Egypt has ever delivered justice. That in fact, the law has often delivered injustice. It has been very prejudiced and biased in the way that that law has functioned. Now, most people would concede that, but then they would argue that this is because Egyptian law itself is flawed, rather than that law itself can never be an arbiter of justice. And this is where I think my book really shares with a long critique of the modern state, where politics is reduced to politics of the state, where the state really comes to dominate and colonize our political imaginary as the primary way of bringing about change. And I also share a very long critique of law that has been going on at least since Benjamin, but I share Walter Benjamin's critique of law as the beacon to which we look for bringing about justice, and which actually then makes us blind to the ways in which law itself is something that has actually been the vehicle for a profound, fundamental, foundational injustice. Even as I say this, I, of course, given that I work in the Middle East, I'm thinking about Iraq and I'm thinking about Syria, where the state is no longer functional. And if it is, it is really a state of destruction that is going about. There is no law, there is no public order, there's absolutely no modicum of social and political life that can be practiced in the shadows of a collapsed state and therefore a collapsed legal order. And so when you think about, for example, Benjamin's critique of law as something that we need to be wary of, on the other hand, is precisely the specter of the destruction of the state and how that kind of destruction only makes the promise of law all the more powerful. And in a sense, I feel like that is our political predicament. And my book participates in that political predicament. It thinks about that political predicament rather than say, oh, you know, law is where justice could be delivered, or say that it is the collapse of the legal order, which is really what we should hearken for, because neither one of those are clearly the solutions. In fact, they are the limits of our political imagination. And even as we inhabit the limits of this political imagination, as human beings, we can perhaps also begin to think beyond them.
Saba Mahmood, anthropology professor for many years at UC Berkeley, talking with me about her book, Religious Difference in a Secular Age, A Minority Report. On our website, againstthegrain.org, we've put a link to that book, as well as to an obituary posted in 2018 on the UC Berkeley Anthropology Department's website, which lays out Saba's background, research emphases, and scholarly contributions and achievements. And a reminder that on tomorrow's program, I will bid a sort of farewell on my last day as a regular host of Against the Grain. Reflections, reminiscences, excerpts from cherished interviews. Hope you'll tune in. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more.